Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What the Indian writer Amitav Ghosh brings to the climate crisis is an origin story. The downfall of the human habitat began, he'll tell you, with a deliberate massacre on a tiny island in the South Pacific exactly 400 years ago. And behind the massacre was a mindset. It decided that quite literally anything was justified in the extension of monopoly trading and imperial power in the Dutch spice trade in the early 17th century. Welcome back, Amitav Ghosh.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
You're my all-star post-colonial mind, historian and novelist with an anthropological eye, born in Calcutta, traveling the far places for a lifetime, from a home base now in Brooklyn. You found a striking parable of our climate disaster in the Nutmeg War of 1621 in what is now Indonesia, just four centuries back, before the emergency that's coming to a boil in Glasgow this week. You write, "The fate of the Banda Islands in the 17th century might be read as a template for the present. If only we knew how to tell that story. By all means, Amitav Ghosh, let's make it a radio story, please."
The story is simply this. The Banda Islands, before the 18th century, it was the only place in the world where the nutmeg tree could be found on the archipelago and its surrounding islands. This was the only part of the world where the nutmeg tree existed. And the nutmeg tree produces two invaluable things. One is the nutmeg and the other is mace. Mace is actually just the outer sort of covering of the nut. So, you know, this tree brought great prosperity, you know, to the Banda Islands. I mean, the Banda Islands are really remote, you know.
Between Australia and Jakarta, I mean, it's, and nothing else around it.
You know, close to Timor. It's a very, very distant part of the world, you know, very hard to get to, remote. These islands are on the Pacific, you know, the Ring of Fire. They're volcanic. In fact, the Banda Islands are basically a kind of caldera, you know, a sunken volcanic cone. The volcano and the winds of the region, they combine in such a way as to create these amazing forests in this region, you know, which is called Maluku now, used to be called the Moluccas. So the forests of this region had the most amazing rarities, you know. I've written about the nutmeg, but there was also cloves. There were all kinds of other sorts of forests produced, which were much in demand. The Bandanese had their nutmegs and their mace. And people came from far, far away to trade in these goods. So really, going back more than two millennia, you know, the nutmeg was a very desired object of trade. Merchants from China, from India, from Africa, the Middle East, would all converge on these islands. Let's also recall that it was because of spices, very, very expensive spices like nutmegs. I mean, in the late Middle Ages, you know, a handful of nutmeg could buy you a house in Europe or a ship. You know, they were phenomenally sort of expensive in Europe, and became even more so when, you know, in the Elizabethan age, when it was put about that nutmegs were a cure for the plague. The desire to sort of find the origin of spices was what really set off, if you like, the voyages of so-called discovery, thereby leading to the finding of America, if you like, by Europeans.
You know, Amitav, may I say, it sounds so quaint, the Dutch spice trade. And yet, when push came to shove, the Dutch, following the Portuguese, came ashore and said, in so many words, leave the island immediately or we'll kill you. And they killed about half the population and enslaved a lot of the rest. I mean, 5,000 people were gone. It's an incredible story to read. I discover now that it's well known, attested by the commander himself and the Dutch forever after.
Yes, the numbers are slightly more than that. I mean, it's actually the population of the islands was 15,000. Exactly how many the Dutch killed with swords and so on, we don't know. But they used swords as well as fire and so on, and also artillery. But of course, early modern technology was not such that you could, you know, just kill a very large number of people with technological means. So what actually happened is that a lot of the islanders fled into the mountains where they starved to death. Many killed themselves. But some, a few hundred, managed to flee. But nonetheless, I mean, it's clear that the Dutch basically either exterminated or enslaved something like more than 90% of the population. I mean, it's a really grim and horrible story. And what makes it so horrible particularly is that the whole thing was precipitated by a tree. I mean, in every civilization in the world, you know, there are these stories of the tree of life. And for the Bandanese, the nutmeg really was their tree of life, and it brought them prosperity. But in the end, it also brought them doom. In that sense, it's not unlike today. We imagine ourselves to be very prosperous, to be living with lots of things. You know, in the interior of America, you can see houses now, they don't just have two cars. They have like four or five cars, you know, for whatever your mood is. You know, you take a car and go about in it. And this seems like prosperity. But in fact, if you're trapped in a wildfire, or you're trapped in a flood, or if a hurricane's hurtling at you, what good is this prosperity going to do? It's actually going to bring doom upon you.
Amitav, you say those settler colonists in the Banda Islands in the 1600s, and there were Dutch men in North America at the same time, you remind us, they were enacting a philosophy which became, in time, you say, official modernity. What is official modernity? Connect more of the dots with the worldwide degradation of the climate.
I'm saying exactly the opposite, actually. What I'm saying is that it was the violence that was launched, that was inaugurated by a certain kind of colonialism, by the European conquest of the Americas. It was that violence that really led to this philosophy.
Which came first, in other words?
I think it was the violence that came first. It's when European colonists began to literally wipe out millions of people in the Americas, that they began to think of themselves as the masters of everything. And not just wiping out millions of people in the Americas, just think of the enormity of the project. They're depopulating two continents, and at the same time, they're repopulating them with enslaved Africans, you know. It's that sense of mastery that actually creates, if you like, the Enlightenment philosophy, in my view. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that, in fact, the philosophers who articulated this philosophy were all in one way or the other connected with the colonial project. I mean, Descartes, you know, he was a Frenchman, but he spent a large part of his life in Holland. He was very closely tied to Dutch elites. In that period, the Dutch elites are also, you know, the leading intellectual elites of the world. So all of that is really interconnected. It's commonplace to think it was the philosophy that led to certain patterns of warfare and so on. But I think it's actually the other way around, that it was this pattern of violence that's inaugurated in this period that creates the philosophy. The philosophy is so much a philosophy of conquest. Mm. You know, the idea is that everything is dead, everything can be used, including humans, most humans. The philosophy also goes that most humans are not really human. They lack reason, they lack the capacity for agential action. So, you know, what else is it but a philosophy of conquest?
And it persists. It's a funny thing, Amitav Ghosh. First time I met you, almost 20 years ago, you remarked that the deepest puzzle about the whole world was that after 400 years, the Anglosphere, the power of the British Empire, and the Dutch, I suppose, but spread out to North America, Australia, the Caribbean, India in some measure, is still there, and the U.S. is running the game today. This book, your book, The Nutmeg's Curse, goes a long way to answering your question. It's a story in so many ways of cruelty, plunder, extraction start to finish, enslavement sometimes, kind of insane entitlement, and a whole lot of denial. The project here is to get over it somehow. Is there any getting over 400 years of that conditioning the myth of progress, our righteousness.
You know, it wasn't all Europeans or all white people, so to speak. I mean, this project was also unleashed on poor Europeans, on poor Western peasants. You know, there were these huge movements of enclosure launched by British elites, which were very strongly resisted by peasants and by many other people. And also, there were these campaigns of extermination, literally extermination, aimed at poor peasant women who were accused of being witches. And the witchcraft craze was completely driven by elites and by elite ideologies, you know.
The enclosure movement that put ownership borders on virtually everything, including people, but enclosure as opposed to the commons.
Exactly. So I think it's important to keep, you know, those distinctions in mind. You know, this was not just a question of one homogenous group launching this violence against people elsewhere. The violence was also launched upon people within Europe, most of all and most violently against Ireland.
And you're arguing that the climate catastrophe has to be accounted by now as a consequence of that history. Fill that out.
I think it's impossible to understand the climate, the planetary crisis of today without reckoning with this history. But the really remarkable thing is that in the West, that is not apparent to people at all. You know, in the West, if you go to any ordinary American or English person and ask them, what is climate change about? Their answer will be that it's to do with technology and science. It's a kind of wonky thing taken care of by technocrats and, you know, that it's, you know, a sort of UN kind of thing. It's all about expert knowledge.
Right.
But if you go to my part of the world, if you go to India, Indonesia, Africa, wherever, and ask people the same question, what they'll say to you is that climate change is actually, I mean, the whole mechanisms around climate change is a way of preserving inequalities, you know, the inequalities that came into being in the period of colonialism. This is at the root of a difference between the ways in which the planetary crisis is seen in the West and in the global South.
Coming up, the disenchantment of this world. This is Open Source. What was lost in those Banda Islands, Amitav Ghosh writes, was not just the land, but the capital L land, the combined living spirits of plants, animals, water, humans, histories, and events. From the indigenous point of view, an intrinsic connection between the Bandanese and the landscape they inhabited had been destroyed for all time. I still wonder, Amitav, how that was acceptable to the thinking of the age.
Many, many Native American scholars and thinkers have argued that, in fact, a land for Native Americans, and this seems to run through Native American culture across both continents, a land has a very, very deep spiritual significance for Native Americans, you know. Notions of space, geography, and the land itself is profoundly spiritually important for them. You know, I think that's a very important point of departure where we can begin really to learn from other conceptions of how we might relate to the earth.
Our thinking is conditioned. I'm thinking of the BP advertising campaign that made the climate crisis essentially every individual's responsibility. You've got to drive less or drive with a more fuel-efficient car. It's about you and us.
Yes, that's been terribly, terribly destructive. I mean, as you know, that was part of a very large-scale advertising campaign, an advertising campaign that was on the whole very successful. It ended up persuading a lot of people that climate crisis was all about individual choices. I mean, not that individual choices are completely unimportant, but basically, you know, it's institutional mechanisms that are really responsible.
We keep breaking into hints of a better understanding. The New York Times last week put four bylines on a big climate story about worsening conflict within and between nations, more dislocation, more migration coming for sure as people flee climate-fueled instability. This is the Times line. It'll mean heightened military tension and uncertainty. The Biden administration, on the way to Glasgow and the UN summit on climate, released all of this in reports about significant challenges to stability worldwide.
It's quite clear that this kind of climate-fueled conflict is absolutely spreading. During the wildfires in Turkey, Turkey accused Greece of being involved in sparking off the wildfires. Similarly, Algeria accused Morocco of setting the wildfires. And I think we are going to see more and more conflicts of this kind, over fires for one, but also over water, over basically safety and security.
You said before to us, Amitav Ghosh, that this scale of climate change is a failure of imagination, both artistic and scientific. You said we must be deranged. We live in an era that worships science. Scientism is all around us, but we cannot take on the lessons that science is teaching us.
Yes, and as we see now, you know, that worship of science is actually really just a worship of technology, of a kind of technology that produces interesting toys, you know.
What's new? How are we doing on the science front or on the imagination front?
On the science front, I think we're pretty much as it was, you know, 5-10 years ago. I mean, the scientific facts have all been known for a very long time. For a long time, we've been promised that there'll be some technology that will spirit away carbon and somehow make us all carbon neutral. Nothing of that kind has appeared yet. On the imaginative front, I think I'm a little more hopeful. Lots of interesting books are being written. I think there's certainly been a distinct shift in the cultural and imaginative landscape.
For example?
Every day now, I'm sent literally 2 or 3 manuscripts, you know, for books or stories or whatever. And the writers invariably say, we were inspired by your book, The Great Derangement, so now you must read this book or you must read my story. You know, I wish I could read all of them, but obviously it's not really possible. Some of them I do read, and some of them are really, really good. I think there's going to be more and more writing of this kind. I just finished, reading a manuscript by a distinguished writer, Bruce Holzinger, in Virginia. And it's a really powerful book about the planetary crisis, a really powerful novel.
Your Nutmeg story is a story of empire, but also of ideas. All of it happened in the 17th and 18th century, known in Europe as the Enlightenment. I want you to draw the line between the Enlightenment and what was happening, but also between the Enlightenment and the Radical Enlightenment.
Well, look, I mean, the Enlightenment produces this kind of, on the one hand, a certain notion of rationality. But there were other notions, you know, of spirituality, of thinking about the earth in certain ways, what I call a vitalist metaphysics, that existed in Europe as well and was actually preserved by a very long line of thinkers, Paracelsus, if you like, and it eventually turned into a kind of esoteric tradition, which was very strong within the West even, well into the 20th century. It's only really in the post-war period that the world has become completely slave to a certain kind of scientism. Now, many climate scientists, atmospheric physicists most of all, often speak of the Earth as a living entity, you know? I mean, they use really very vitalist metaphors. Very notably, James Lovelock, he presents the Earth as Gaia, as a goddess, as a Greek goddess, really.
You write, the advance of modernity encompasses this desacralized, inanimate Earth with nature as an inert entity in which vitalism is not quite crushed. It's sort of pushed to the margins. It's a cluster of ideas and different traditions that serve countercultural movements to this day. What you call official modernity comes to honor an ideology of conquest, you're saying, which would eventually become hegemonic in the West and is now shared by the entire global elite. To envisage the world in this way, you write, was a crucial step toward making an inert nature a reality. You quote Ben Ehrenreich saying, only once we imagined the world as dead could we dedicate ourselves to making it so.
Look, in the first place, that particular kind of sort of mechanistic reasoning, you know, it was the province of actually a very small elite, essentially a masculine elite. But this elite was very powerful, and it dedicated itself to the eradication of vitalist ideas across the world, not least in Europe. As I said, you know, they unleashed this witchcraft craze against the beliefs of peasants and especially of peasant women. But similarly, they unleashed this violence against Native Americans. In the United States, freedom of religion is actually a paramount, fundamental, constitutional and legal principle. Yet Native Americans were basically forbidden to practice their religion, you know, from the 1880s onwards. And those rights were really returned to them very recently, late in the 20th century. So what were they actually so afraid of? And what they were afraid of was really these vitalist beliefs. For some reason, it seems to have terrified them.
You have a very modern education, Amitav Ghosh. How did you discover a kind of innate sensitivity to those messages? And what are they for us today?
You know, I was brought up in a household where, you know, we saw vitality in all things around us all the time. That may have something to do with it. But yes, as you say, you know, I'm very highly educated. I have a DPhil from Oxford. That sense of the vitality of the earth never really completely disappeared from me, you know. As these climate change events unfold around us, my awareness of the vitality of the earth and of non-human beings is becoming, I would say, stronger.
Well, you know, I don't know that it disappeared for any of us entirely.
Yes.
I love Emerson's line. His first famous essay was called Nature, and it included this line that I love. The greatest delight of the fields and woods is the suggestion of an occult relation between man and vegetable. I will be a naturalist, he said.
Yes, exactly. I think Emerson is a very good example of that. Although Emerson acknowledges all kinds of influences, including from Hinduism and so on, I like to think that, in fact, what Americans of his period actually absorbed was something of Native American wisdom, you know, because you do see the sense of the occult being very pronounced in 18th and 19th century America.
Yeah.
Just look at the work of Poe. You know, it's very hard to think of Edgar Allan Poe being born and, you know, writing like that in France or England. I think that was something that they did absorb really from both the space and the land of America, but also the people who lived there. They would never acknowledge those debts, I think. But there was a debt.
Well, Thoreau did. I think somewhere in all of us is a trace of that transcendental idea that all living things reflect a divine soul and are connected in nature.
The problem there is with all living things. You know, what do we mean by all living things? I mean, within science, they have this idea of the organic and the inorganic. And so rocks and stones are thought to be inorganic. But Native Americans and, you know, indigenous peoples in many places recognize life in entities that we would not call living things. I mean, like Native peoples of the American Northwest say that they can understand and communicate with glaciers. They can communicate with geological phenomena. And again, that's one set of things that today perhaps we would not recognize as living. And the other thing that we would not recognize, and which Native Americans and so on did recognize, was a spirit world, you know, a vast spirit world. Just a teeming spirit world all around them. And I think that's, again, very interesting, because would we recognize those as living things? No. But in fact, I mean, within Native American philosophy, you cannot actually recognize life in a tree unless you also recognize that the tree has a spirit.
Some people think volcanoes are the earth talking. There may be a problem of language here. Who gets to speak or who gets to be listened to?
You know, actually the Bandanese believed that their volcanoes were producing prophecies. And it's actually a kind of uncanny how often their volcanoes would erupt when they spotted an invader coming. The first time a Dutch ship approached the Banda Islands, the volcano erupted. There is a strange sort of element of what we would now call precognition in these things. Across the length and breadth of Indonesia, there are so many beliefs about volcanoes. And actually, if you think about it, a volcano is a very, very living thing. You know, it's where the earth shows itself to be sort of really alive and churning. And I find it interesting in that sense that, you know, within Europe or within the West, the country that has been quickest to accord personhood to certain geological entities like glaciers is Iceland, you know, which is again a volcanic archipelago, you know. The Icelanders recently have started holding funerals for glaciers. And I think this is a very big step forward. I think it's in Spain now. They're giving names to heat waves. I think these are the ways in which we are recovering a certain kind of personhood for phenomena that we did not recognize as being alive before.
You sound like a convert, and it's a good sign. You write, the inescapable evidence of destruction today, fires, floods, storms, droughts, express emotions too of a damaged earth and people's loss of belief, connection, cultural, even religious attachment. You quote a writer saying, the planet will never come alive for you unless your songs and stories give life to all the beings, seen and unseen, that inhabit a living earth, a living entity.
Yes, I do think that's the case. And in fact, now we have this whole branch called TEK. It's a whole branch of study, which is a traditional ecological knowledge. And what this branch tries to do is that it tries to abstract what we might call appropriate certain kinds of indigenous wisdom and turn it into sort of like usable technologies. What they don't recognize is that all these forms of indigenous wisdom arise out of stories, out of songs, out of culture in the deepest sense. And that's really my hope for literature as we go ahead, that literature will again ground us within that kind of wisdom.
What are the classics of the genre in your reading life, of a spirited, vitalist understanding of the world?
There are, of course, any number of pre-modern texts, vast numbers of them, you know, the great epics, whether we speak of India or we speak of the Greek epics and so on. In all these stories, we see so many kinds of non-human beings, you know, who act, who have language, who have agency, and so on. But closer to our time, I mean, in this contemporary moment, Richard Powers is certainly one writer who's been trying to deal with this fundamental question of how do we give voice to non-human beings.
Amitav Ghosh, speak of the UN conference in Glasgow to do something about carbon in the sky, emission standards, a defense against climate change. But I'd love you to see it in the context of an unofficial current that I sense more and more, a sort of soul project, a COVID-era move. Families I know settling on farms again, and more independent living, with the very conscious thought that the age of extraction has turned somehow.
I think that is actually the case. I think the pandemic has actually accelerated a lot of that. It was curious. I was in Paris a month ago, and it was incredible how friendly and good-natured people were. I mean, I've been in Paris many times, and I've never seen people being so friendly and good-natured. Parisians are famously rude and are kind of brusque in their manner. But they were so friendly, and many of my friends there said that this was an effect of the pandemic, that people had just become very much nicer towards each other. In the same way, I don't think I see that in New York, but what I do see across the United States, and it's very evident in the employment statistics, people are turning their backs on that completely mechanical kind of life that they had lived for so long. I mean, they just lived like machines. They're looking for something else. The fashionable term is work-life balance. So what people will say is that they're looking for a better work-life balance, but in fact, they're looking for a lot else. They're just looking for human connections. They're looking for, you know, life in more manageable spaces. And as you say, they're looking to be closer to the land often. You know, I do feel that there is a massive sort of a cultural shift happening. But on the other hand, in India, China, Indonesia, etc., is going in exactly the opposite direction. People are just accelerating more and more into that sort of machine living, you know. So there are two contradictory things happening there.
Amitav Ghosh is our guest, tracking the origins of the climate crisis at the United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow this week and next, dubbed COP26, it fell to the eminent 95-year-old naturalist David Attenborough to focus attention on the spike of fossil fuel carbon in the atmosphere, a main measure of the planetary emergency.
We are already in trouble. The stability we all depend on is breaking. This story is one of inequality as well as instability. Today, those who've done the least to cause this problem are being the hardest hit. Ultimately, all of us will feel the impact, some of which are now unavoidable. It comes down to this. The people alive now are the generation to come, will look at this conference and consider one thing. Did that number stop rising and start to drop as a result of commitments made here? There's every reason to believe that the answer can be yes. If working apart, we are a force powerful enough to destabilize our planet, surely working together, we are powerful enough to save it.
That was Sir David Attenborough in Glasgow this week. Coming up, the vitalist alternative, learning to think of the planet as one life system, not a resource. This is Open Source. Amitav Ghosh draws on history, human behavior, and a novelist's imagination in his Parables for a Planet in Crisis. The breakdown of our climate, he argues in his new book, The Nutmeg's Curse, is rooted in Europe's imperial conquests going back four centuries, under the convenient assumption that violent colonization and extraction without end came without cost. He says the end of the process could be omnicide, the death of everything. But he can also see a cure in rediscovering and revaluing a living Earth. It's a way of thinking called vitalism.
Well, you know, in this book, I make the case for what I call a vitalist politics. And it's a politics which really would arise out of a different kind of a way of relating to the Earth. When I say that, it sounds absurd. You might say, what could be a vitalist politics and what chance would it have in this world? But, you know, actually, when we look back on the politics of the 20th century, some of the most powerful movements were, in fact, vitalist movements. Mahatma Gandhi's movement of nonviolent resistance, for example, was very much founded on many very powerful vitalist notions. And if you consider that Gandhi had an enormous impact on the civil rights movement in the Americas, That again is something really remarkable. I think in recent years, resistance to globalization and the Occupy movement, again, I would say that the Occupy movement, what it actually did, its powerful legacy really lay in trying to model a different way of living. And it's interesting that the Occupy movement called itself that, because, you know, what it does by talking about occupation is to present a different way of relating to space, you know, a space that is not, as it were, privatized and individualized, but a space that is a collective form. The longest, most effective resistance to fossil fuel industries have come from whom? From movements that are led by indigenous people and especially indigenous women. If you look at the No DAPL movement, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Standing Rock movement.
Standing Rock, I was just going to say.
Yeah, and also in Virginia, black and indigenous groups led a very effective resistance to an oil pipeline. This is not just a pie in the sky. I mean, I think certain kinds of vitalist politics are actually becoming more and more important. And I hope that they become ever more so. But another sort of aspect of, you know, these new vitalist forms of politics and thought that are arising around us is really in judicial cases, you know. I mean, I think it was a Supreme Court bench in New Zealand that accorded personhood to a river, you know, and rivers have now been recognized as persons in many places. And it's quite interesting. And I mean, I'm sure those judges who passed this judgment in New Zealand were actually, I mean, in private, they would have scoffed at the idea that a river can be your ancestor or that a river can be a being. And yet they were willing to pass this judgment. So I do feel that, you know, there is a sort of major shift occurring in the ways in which people think about the world.
You write a lot in The Nutmeg's Curse about what you've learned from Native Americans and others who've experienced environmental death. You write about the shaman from the rainforest in Brazil, known as Davi Kopanawa. He speaks from inside that experience of life worlds being extinguished. And he comes forward in a sort of spirit being, talking to us humans, trying to help us white folks especially see the forest truly. Speak about Kopanawa.
Oh, I think Kopanawa is one of the most amazing figures of modern times. You know, he's a shaman of the Yanomami people.
In the rainforest of Brazil, yeah.
Yes, and he's been resisting corporations for a very long time. He's been resisting, you know, all kinds of settler violence. And he's a deeply spiritual person, you know. You know, even in cultures that believe in shamanism, like the Yanomami, it's not like everyone is a shaman. You know, people with specialized talents become shamans, you know, and they go through very intense training. It takes years for them to actually actualize their gifts. We know that the human mind is capable of many, many things. I mean, I know, for example, that mathematicians, you know, have a phenomenal gift for, say, numbers and a certain kind of logic, and that I don't. I also know other people have other gifts. I mean, you know, some people are very good with dogs, for example, or very good with horses. You know, so why should it not be the case that there are people who have these specialized gifts? You know, humans have believed this for millennia. What makes us think that we know better than our ancestors? It's clear that we don't know better. In fact, if we knew better, we wouldn't have done what we've done to the planet.
But speak, Amitav, of what Davi Kopanawa is saying and what he's telling us, what he's told you. He's massively published now. What's the message to be acted on?
Oh, there are so many messages. But most of all, he's making this argument, you know, that you can't treat the forest merely as an object to be managed. So basically, his ideas about the forest and his ideas about the earth are completely vitalist. You know, he within that Native American worldview, there is actually no difference between people and animals and other beings. They're all spirits of a certain kind. It's the bodies that are different, but in spirit, they're all the same. And I think this is a very important sort of alternative view.
He also seems to think that to understand the forest truly, it helps to abandon words. I like that notion. Richard Powers's character, Plant Patty, has the same notion. You sort of bathe yourself in a tree. But what does that mean?
Mystics everywhere have always said that it's when you get beyond language that you perceive the nature of reality. You know, I mean, that's a strong tradition within Christianity even. Christian Gnostics and mystics believe that. It's certainly also true of various Indic traditions. It's true of Sufism. So, you know, that's a tradition that you could say exists worldwide, the belief that it's when you get beyond words that you actually perceive the nature of reality.
One of the funny things about this time is the ability to identify extractive industries and to see their almost incredible power in American life in the 20th century. Generations of the Rockefeller family, for example, the Bush family, which always seemed to me creatures of the Rockefeller interest, the Koch family in coal, pulling strings even as we speak, and not just of Joe Manchin on the matter of the filibuster, the senator from West Virginia who feels he has to answer to the Koch signals, but we're beginning to see it in a kind of place where we can confront it, perhaps, surface it. The attractive power that translates very literally directly to our politics.
You know, fossil fuels are incredibly powerful. I mean, and not just because of their energy, but the way they interact with people. They've absolutely insinuated themselves into American and Western life, and really global life, in ways that are so insidious that we don't even recognize all of them. In relation to Senator Joe Manchin, it should also be pointed out that it's not just someone else manipulating him. He has massive investments in fossil fuels himself, you know, and he comes from a sort of family of fossil fuel entrepreneurs. So that's just one way in which, you know, you can see the power of fossil fuels within the American Congress. And the same is true of coal interests in Australia, for example. But there is one aspect of it that I think we don't pay enough attention to, you know, the way that fossil fuels have become so implicated in geopolitics. 20 or 30 years ago, nobody would have thought that, you know, tiny, you know, oil and gas producing nations would become so incredibly powerful. But today, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, they're like global players. They're involved in every geopolitical strategy that there is. But most of all, you know, what these oil sheikhdoms have really figured out is how to manipulate the United States and the United Kingdom. They've become incredibly powerful, actually, and they're incredibly skilled. It has to be handed to them.
In Trump time, for sure, but forever?
Yes, yes, but very much so. After 9/11, remember, I mean, there were so many Saudis on those planes. All the Saudis were able to leave America in planes provided by the Bush administration. This meeting of interests is so powerful, and certainly, you know, the Gulf sheikhdoms have become so skilled. They understand exactly which buttons to push in America and in England, you know, and mostly those buttons have to do with money. But they know how to use their money to very good diplomatic effect.
How's to confront it?
I don't know. I mean, in fact, if you followed what's happening with COP26, the Saudis have been instrumental in watering down the language.
This is Glasgow.
Yeah.
Amitav Ghosh, you've introduced this word omnicide as the extension of the logic of the nutmeg's curse. Kill everything. That's an ominous usage. What do you mean?
Think of the phrase that Conrad used in The Heart of Darkness, exterminate all the brutes. Literary criticism has usually considered that this phrase applied to humans, to Africans. But I think it was much more than that. I mean, in fact, what Mr. Kurtz really wanted was to obliterate everything there, you know, the landscape, the trees, the jungle, everything. He just felt the deepest antipathy and hatred towards it. That's something you see constantly in colonial ventures. I mean, for example, early settlers in New England, they hated the swamps. They wanted them drained as soon as possible. They didn't like the forests even. They wanted the forests to be gone. They wanted it all to look like England. That idea is really what is behind now this strange, this bizarre sort of millenarian movement to go and settle on Mars. You know, I think that's really what it is. What they're actually saying is that everything on Earth must be abandoned, that everything on Earth is worthless. Let's go off and, you know, try again on another planet. You would think that they would ask themselves, humans had a wonderful planet filled with life and filled with beauty, and they've wrecked it. How do you expect them to make a great success out of planets that are actually much more impoverished than Earth?
I think you can locate that thought among the scientists who are working on changing our genome. If this place becomes uninhabitable, we must be adaptable to someplace else. It may be Jeff Bezos' greatest fantasy that he's leading the way to something. I can't imagine that thought will prevail, though.
It's a fantasy, obviously, but it's a fantasy that's really taken hold of these people. And in pursuing this fantasy, they're generating, it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because all those rockets now are generating incredible quantities of greenhouse gases, you know, as they blast off from Earth. So it's an appalling thing. I mean, this Sir Richard Branson claimed to care about the climate. He said he was going to give $1 billion to it. It's never turned up. And now, instead of doing that, he's trying to blast off into outer space, creating incredible, expanding his carbon footprint, a millionfold, I imagine.
Amitav Ghosh, speak as the man I think you are, an artist who wanders and watches so inventively. In this moment, what are you, or what are we, what is the Earth going through? How will it be written, remembered? How will this story be told?
Oh, it can. How can it be told except as a story of dystopia, of complete dystopia? What we see all around us increasingly. I mean, you think of those people in Paradise, California. I mean, they're up at 7 o'clock trying to get their children to school, and by 9 o'clock, the entire town is engulfed by fire. Or you think of the people who are increasingly displaced by hurricanes all around the world. You think of all these mega droughts. You think about these amazing heat waves. So, what we do see increasingly, in India today, people I was talking to was just listing one disaster after another that's unfolding in the Indian subcontinent.
We talked with India about an earlier stage of COVID. What are they talking about today?
Well, today what we were talking about most of all was, these rain bomb events that have unfolded, huge floods in parts of the mountain regions, massive floods also in Nepal. These are the spectacular things. Along with these floods, there are also these long-standing droughts that are really making large tracts of land uncultivable. And along with all of that, increasing social tensions, increasing political instability everywhere. I mean, who would have thought a country as held up to be the model of global stability for centuries, like the United Kingdom, would become so destabilized by migration, that it led to Brexit, it led to an upheaval in their whole entire political life. This planetary crisis is manifesting itself all around us in so many ways that it can no longer be hidden,
That's what the Earth is going through, but I'm still wondering, what are we going through? What will the story be of us responders or non-responders?
No, it's not just the Earth. It's us as well. I mean, after all, it's we who suffered through this pandemic, didn't we? It's we who are suffering through these terrible climate events. But most of all, I think, the political instability and polarization that you see around you and that everyone can see around them is also to a great degree really founded upon this entire planetary crisis.
You've given an account of what I call a soul project in this time, moral, spiritual, and I also wonder about the political project, or will it simply follow the emotions and the spirit of things? Is there a more active way to stand up in this time?
Well, I don't like to make prophecies and predictions, but I think we can all see that it's not heading in a very good direction anywhere. I can only hope that, writers, film directors, creative people of all kinds will give us new ways of looking at the reality around us, especially this incredibly dystopic reality that we are increasingly dealing with.
Amitav Ghosh, it's hard news in your book, The Nutmeg's Curse, but it's always a challenge and pleasure to talk with you.
It was great to talk to you, Chris. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
We'll do it again.
Yes, absolutely.
Amitav Ghosh's new book is The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. At our site, radioopensource.org, you'll find a variety of conversations over the years with Amitav, around his three novels about Britain's opium wars with China in the 19th century, and about the Great Derangement, as he called it, in our own era. Please think of supporting the hardest working team in radio. You can leave a tip at radioopensource.org or become a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations on all sorts of subjects, In the coming week, hear producer Adam Coleman's conversation with Darren Lone Fite about indigenous pop culture. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is our vitalist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is proud to be a part of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit collective of great independent podcasts. Check out Soonish, a podcast about technology and the future, from journalist Wade Rausch. In his episode, Goodbye Google, Wade takes a deep look at the controversy over Google's firing of a prominent black computer scientist who wrote about the danger of gender and racial bias in the company's AI algorithms. Listen in at soonishpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.